I'm someone who loves trying out different makeup looks, but doesn't really wear much on a daily basis, so I like to focus on making sure I have high quality staples. And whether you like a fresh face, full glam, or somewhere in between, you've probably seen Thrive Cosmetics' viral tubing mascara. I've certainly seen it everywhere. You know the one in the turquoise tube? So that mascara, along with all of Thrive Cosmetics' beauty products, are certified 100% vegan and cruelty-free, which I look for in makeup, and they've got excellent quality to match. And something I didn't know from all the mascara videos I've seen is that for every product sold, Thrive Cosmetics donates either that same product, another product that is needed more, or a monetary donation. They've worked with over 500 nonprofits to help with a wide range of causes like supporting cancer survivors, people experiencing homelessness, education access, and so much more. Knowing that makes me feel even better about using their products. And I do enjoy using them. Like I said, I like having high quality staples, and so my favorites are products that are multi-purpose, like the Brilliant Eye Brightener. It comes in a bunch of colors, and I like using them as eyeliner, eyeshadow, and even highlighter. Thrive Cosmetics is luxury beauty that gives back. Right now, you can get an exclusive 20% off your first order at thrivecosmetics.com/thrive. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS. .com/thrive for 20% off your first order. Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
It's time for the Life Writing Podcast with your hosts, authors and screenwriters Stephen Barnes and Tanana Reeve Du. All about creating the project of your dreams while living a balanced artist life. Be the hero or heroine of your own story. Sponsored by LifeWritingPremium.com. Get ready to write for your life.
Welcome to the Life Writing Podcast, where married authors and screenwriters Stephen Barnes and Tanana Reeve Du talk about writing during stressful times, breaking into Hollywood, and balancing life. Every week, we share more tips on how to build a better life while you create your dream projects, even if it's only at the rate of one sentence a day. Life writing is the application of the tools of writing to life and the tools of life to your writing. Welcome, everybody. Welcome. Hello. Applause. Okay. There it is. A little delay there. Yes. You have probably noticed there's only a soul voice today. Steve is a little bit under the weather after his much touted trip to Manila, but international travel does take its toll. So he is regretfully sitting this one out while I get to have our great guest all to myself, Alma Katsu, who is going to join me in just a little bit. But before, you know how we do it on this podcast, before we bring on the guest, I'm going to talk a little bit about what's going on. I get to hog it all today since Steve isn't here to talk about what's going on with him. I signed a contract for a new novel a week ago as of when this comes out. So I'm very excited about that. Some of you may know I took a long vacation from writing novels, not intentionally. It just took so dang long to write The Reformatory, and it's so hard to try to break into Hollywood that I ended up writing a couple of short story collections worth of short stories while I was working on The Reformatory, but no novel since I think 2011 was when my last novel was published. So I am getting back in the saddle. This is big for me. And I'm on deadline, which is very different because, as you can probably tell by how often I've said it took me 7 years to write the reformatory, I did not have a deadline for that. My agent and I decided early on that we would write it on spec and not sell it up front, which I think was a good idea, but it took a long time. And for many, many reasons, let's just say 2023 taught me that I am very, very happy to still be a novelist in addition to a screenwriter. Hollywood is a whole mess right now. Wow, it's just crazy with all the people losing their jobs. And yeah, I think I'm not going to give up on the pitching. We had good news in terms of a project that had issues, and now maybe we're back in the saddle. But again, it's all so speculative that realizing, oh, wait, I write novels is a huge revelation to me. And I have an idea for it. I don't want to say because it hasn't been announced, but what I have said on social media is that this novel is set in the same world as a couple of short stories that I published recently, one of which might have won an award. I'm not going to go into it, but when it's announced, and I also, Steve and I wrote a spec script that will be the loose outline for my novel. So it is well and thoroughly outlined in script form. I'm sure I will divert from that in novel form. I already have ideas for scenes that are not in that script, but it's a little scary to be back on deadline. Some of you may have seen on social media that for fun over the past month or so, I taught myself the choreography to the Thriller video, which I put up on my Instagram and Twitter and everywhere. And it, you know, it actually took a long time. And it's so funny because my editor saw it and he was like, aren't you supposed to be writing a novel? So that's what I said. I laughed. And I am writing it in my head right now, but I'm getting out of the, I'm finishing up the short story Steve and I are working on for the upcoming anthology set in the world of The Stand. I think it's called The End of the World as We Know It. No pressure. No pressure there at all to write a really, really great short story. And we're taking our time with it. I'm trying to get the research right. I will say that it's a child protagonist, which is, you know, that's my sweet spot. I love to do that, but hoping to wrap that up. It's due April 1st, but hoping to wrap it up before April 1st, and then I'll be fully engaged in working on the new book. So I'm very excited about all that stuff. I'm writing is what I'm trying to say. Let me talk about our guest because she's here and I can't wait to talk to her. Alma Katz's books have been nominated and won multiple prestigious awards, including the Bram Stoker Award, Goodreads Reader's Choice, the International Thrillers Award, Locus Magazine, the Western Heritage Awards. You know, there's a bunch of them here. You don't need to know them all. Just know they're there. She's written two spy novels, Red Widow and Red London, the logical marriage of her love of storytelling with her 30-plus year career in intelligence. But if you're like me, you first got to know her from her horror novels. The Hunger, a reimagining of the story of the Donner Party, was named one of NPR's 100 favorite horror stories, was on numerous best books of the year lists. And her novel, The Fervor, which I also love, tackles the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II with a demonic twist. So with no further ado, our guest, Alma Katz.
Thank you so much. It's such a thrill to be here with you.
And I am pronouncing your name correctly, I hope. Please correct me if not. I will redo the whole thing.
No.
That's great.
Perfect.
So, I, you know, admirer from afar, you're also on social media quite a bit. So I feel like I first got to know you through social media, but we actually got to meet in person at the Miami Book Fair back in 2022, I think it was, when we were on a panel. You, me, Steve, right?
Yep. Actually, though, it goes back further than that. I'm pretty sure I shared a stage with you, didn't I? At the Decatur Book Festival in 2011.
Okay, 2011.
Were so kind to me, so kind. And I've never forgotten that kindness. Yeah,
2011.
Yeah, my first book, The Taker, was kind of a big book for Simon & Schuster. So they sent me out on this crazy book tour. And at Decatur, I'm pretty sure they put the two of us on a stage. And yeah, and I was thinking, what am I doing on a stage with this woman? Because she's such a great writer and she's so well known. And I'm just this little debut. And you guys, they said, were so kind to me. I'll never forget it.
Well, forgive me for not remembering that.
That's
2011,
okay.
Decatur, Georgia. That was during the time when Steve and I had moved to Atlanta when my mother was ill. I call that time the vortex. Like, I lost whole memories of people I knew, like friends I had. Like, when I came back to LA, I was like, oh, I had totally forgotten that I had a friendship with this person. It's such a traumatic thing, you know, watching a parent who's ill and eventually passed away. So that's the excuse I'm going to use, but I'm glad we were kind. And congratulations, you hit with that was your debut novel?
That was my debut, yeah.
You hit with a bang, my dear. That's not the usual story.
No, I was very lucky. And we can talk about career trajectory. I can't speak anymore. Career arcs, right? You know, no one is up there all the time. There's always highs and lows. And when you start out with that kind of gift, you don't realize that there's going to be plenty of years where you're not getting that kind of support and everything. But yeah, I was super lucky with the first book.
Let me ask you about that book. Was that the first like novel that you completed, or was that just the first one you published?
That was one of those horrible pushing the rock up the hill things. It was I wrote it. It took me 10 years,
Ooh,
10 years of writing my book every day to get it to the point where it was saleable. Cause it's such a weird, complex book. It's definitely not the kind of book that should be your debut. It had too many difficult things for a writer that I had to learn how to do. So, and I wrote other novels during that time. Like if I ran into a wall, I would put it aside and I'd work on another novel. So I actually finished a couple other novels, but that was the first one to sell and the first one to get published.
That is so fortunate, you know, I mean, not the journey, because it's hard to learn how to writing a novel. Well, in our life writing program, we really do teach people to learn how to write with short stories, because as you say, it's so difficult. The complexities of a novel can be tough, but a lot of people do start with novels because that's what they read.
Right. Well, I did write a few short stories. I didn't consider myself a short story writer. I went through a master's program there's a whole crazy story about this. You know, I'm very old and I've had a whole career. The two careers overlapped for a while. When I was 40, I returned back to writing. And it was like, I was one of those crazy kids that always wrote up until my early 20s. But then when I went into intelligence, they kind of make you stop doing things in the outside world. So I stopped and I didn't return to it till I was 40.
Wow.
And you can imagine, right? It was like getting up off the couch after you've been eating potato chips for 10 years, saying, I'm going to run a marathon. So, you know, I sucked, but it gave me great pleasure. And so I decided I'm going to go back to get a degree and see if that helped. And I don't think you have to get a degree to do this. So, but going through that program, of course, you write short stories. And so I wrote a few and didn't realize the huge difference.
There is a difference.
There's stories and novels, but the idea that had come to me was a novel. And so I just really wanted to see if I could write this novel.
I am stunned by that story. That's great. That's a great story. What I love about it is this notion that, which is so true about writing, it's never too late. And 40, by the way, is not that old. You could have said 50, you could have said 60, you could have said 70. Hell, right. You could have said 80, you know, as long as the cognitive function is still there. It's just, I love that about writing, is it's something that you can come back to after a long time away. But it was smart, I think, for you to use an MFA program, because if you weren't going to do that, it would have been a circle of readers to help give you that same, you know, that same guidance that I think is so important.
Yeah, I mean, not to discourage anyone from going into a master's program, because you will get a lot out of it. And gosh, master's programs have changed a lot since I went in, which was like around 2000. You know, there's many programs now that teach genre, for instance. Back then, you know, my work was kind of genre, and I kept, you know, I got a lot of snickers from my classmates and stuff like that, you know, persevered. Yeah, it's
did that discourage you? Because let's talk about genre bias. I agree with you that things are changing, but genre bias is real. I experienced it, not from instructors, but from classmates. You know, when I said one of my favorite authors was Stephen King, you would think I was running around naked in a classroom. By the way, people just kind of fell silent. like, oh my God, how could she mention Stephen King's name here? You know, right. So how did you have just the personal sense of ownership over your own creativity not to be swayed? Because my reaction to that was to try to start writing contemporary realism with white male characters, to be honest.
Yeah, I can understand that. Well, maybe, I don't know what time of your life you went through all that, if you went on to grad school, like right after undergrad, but going to it so late in life was one thing. And the second thing is, in my other career, I had been very, very successful. I had just finished being a national intelligence officer at 40, which is not done. And so I had a lot of confidence in my ability.
Oh, good. Good for you.
And I could shut these people down pretty easily. Also, not
you've dealt with worse situations than
that. Oh my God, yes. Like, these people thought that they could when you're at that level, you have to argue, you know, pretty decisively. Let's put it that way.
Lives are at stake, right? In those arguments, not just whether you like the story or not.
You're briefing the National Security Council or something, right? You cannot have a failure of confidence at that point, and you have to be well prepared. So, and the other thing I will say is, I was probably, the instructors in the program were already sort of treating me like one of the more gifted students, right? And again, I'm not bragging. It's just, I think when you go into it older, you have a lot more experience. I certainly had a lot more experience being edited at CIA, which is one of the places where I worked. The editing is soul crushing. Much worse than a publishing house. So, you know, I had these other, you know, kind of experiences that buffered me a little bit more, maybe, against that kind of peer pressure. And the other thing was, is I could see too, where a lot of times they were wrong. You know, when, especially in those critique classes, your instructor is one thing, but the students, it's often the blind leading the blind. They don't really know what needs to be changed, what's right, what's wrong. They can give their opinions. And I hope to God critique classes are a lot nicer. And I was in a huge cohort. So the average size of our critique classes was over 20 students.
Oh, that's a lot.
And it is a lot. And it was a little bit like Mean Girls at high school, you know, like you could, there were cliques that were always just trying to force people down. So me and a couple other students that, you know, the professors always had nice things to say, you know, we tried to sort of protect each other.
Oh, that's good. And I do hope that that sort of cutthroat element has changed, because there are programs. I've heard stories. I never actually got an MFA. I got a master's in English literature, but never did get an MFA. But I have heard stories that people will try to sort of be self-aggrandizing by putting other people down and try to make themselves look so smart and so good. And yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, I think that's something, even aside from those kinds of programs, if you get in a writer's group and you're not in the position where you can really select your partners, you know, you stand the chance of running up against that too. It's unfortunately just sort of part of the experience.
Well, anyway. you have survived all of that to become really this sort of two-headed, I was going to say beast, but that's not what I really
mean. A
two-headed entity, where your most recent novel goes back to your expertise in national security and intelligence. But a lot of our listeners, and certainly what we call the horror community and horror family, know you for the hunger and the fervor. So let's talk about that, because we talked about that a little bit at the Miami Book Fair, like positioning. I've known authors in the past who literally would write under a pseudonym when they switched between genres. And that idea always kind of mortified me, because even though my name is long and somewhat unpronounceable to some people, I'm proud of my name. I would hate to like spend years working on a project and not have my name on it. It's just vanity at this point. So did you ever consider a pseudonym? Did anyone ever suggest it?
Well, it's funny you bring that up, because, you know, I don't have your average, you know, middle American name. And as a matter of fact, it's two different ethnicities, of which I, you know, own those two different ethnicities. But I think that name alone causes a lot of confusion. So when I started, I asked, should I have a more generic pseudonym? And they made the decision, no, it's a little exotic, but, you know, let's go with it. Ever since then, it's always been this debate. Should I have a pseudonym? Should I change my name, et cetera, et cetera? I did bring it up for the spy novels, but my publisher at the time really felt that they would be able to market me to two different audiences. I can't say that that succeeded. So,
but here you are still Amakatsu.
Trying. It's very hard. I'd be really interested to hear about your experiences, but those two genres are so different. And if you think about it, you know, how many people who really love horror are going to be into spy novels and vice versa? And the other thing, which I really want to get your take on, is both genres are not traditionally female centric, right?
True.
I mean, horror, I think, is getting so much better, but spy novels, forget it. It's the gatekeepers.
Exactly.
The gatekeepers are men, and I think old men for the most part, who have this ideal in their head. Let's just say James Bond. There's a few more. And that's what they want. They want stories that follow that plot line that are about male protagonists and exploring male protagonists, you know, views and experiences and that sort of thing. And when you add on top the depressing research that shows that a lot of men will not read a book written by a woman. So when you put those two together, it's just been really hard to build an audience. My spy series is the protagonist is a woman and a young woman. And I did that on purpose because I wanted to show what it's like for women and contemporary women, right, who work in intelligence, because there are some nuances to it, but it's still, I think, a good spy story. And men have told me they've enjoyed it, but it's been really hard to build an audience. And it's so confusing for my readers. I'm going to a bookstore and I see all the books together, usually on the horror shelf. And the two spy novels are so obviously, you know, the covers are so obviously not horror. And yeah, it's just so confusing. So what was it like for you?
It is an interesting juggling act.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system. So wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm. You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales, because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's R-A-K-U-T-E-N.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
You know, I often think back to around, I think it was 2000 when I published, well, my first two books were horror novels, and I was trying to build up my career as a horror novelist. And then I got the opportunity to write a historical novel called The Black Rose with the Alex Haley estate about Madam C.J. Walker. I added a little bit of a fantasy element with One Dream, but that was about it. It's all grounded contemporary, I mean, grounded realism in history. And the next book was The Living Blood, which was this epic, world-trotting, immortals, magic, blood, horror, And I thought the readers who found me through The Black Rose are going to be so confused by The Living Blood. And it is kind of hard to unify those readers. We've done mystery novels. Steve and I did some mystery novels with Blair Underwood. We call them erotic thrillers, but they were at their core mysteries. People died and we had to figure out who they were. Never got any traction in the mystery community. Weren't marketed, frankly, into the mystery community. They went right down the line, I think, of just let's let Blair be the famous face on the cover and the readers will come, with mixed results, I would say. And then also Steve and I did some young adult zombie novels. Now, those were horror, but they were also young adult, not marketed, however, as young adult for whatever reason. And I feel like in all those cases, they didn't quite find their audience. Right. So I don't believe that those books did as well as my solo horror novels did. And there could be a variety of reasons for that. And since then, I've pretty much stayed, I mean, when I publish books, which isn't always that frequently, they're horror, they're Afrofuturism, science fiction. I mean, all in that same sort of family where people are familiar. It's tough. You know, that marketing piece is not a joke. And you did have that really heady experience of your first novel being such a hit that they toured you during a time when, frankly, a lot of my touring had stopped, after 2011.
Yeah.
So the sort of ebbing and flowing with the business. And then was The Hunger your next novel after that?
Well, The Taker was a trilogy.
Oh, okay.
And, yeah. So there were three books. I forget when the last one came out, but there was a little bit of a gap between the last book in the trilogy and The Hunger. Yeah. You know, at least you have, like this persona, right? I think when people hear your name, even if it's not strictly horror or, strictly some other thing, they know what to expect. You know, you have a brand, right? I hate to. So maybe it's, I have a feeling that your fans are likely to try to follow you. I'm just saying that for everyone else, kids, don't try this at home. It's really, really tough. And you're absolutely right about the marketing part. And, I can't come from the government. We don't do marketing. I had no idea. I just assumed everybody in these jobs did their job really well. And I'm not saying they don't, but it's a matter of there's only so much money and so much attention and so much time. And it tends to go to a handful of books at any publishing house. And then the rest of the folks, you don't learn this until your second or third book.
Yeah.
You certainly don't learn it with your first. It's helpful if you can jump in and really shorten, really give them ideas for how you think the book should be marketed. When I started, I kind of sat back because it wasn't my field. And I figured,
right, take it away.
Right.
Boom. Where's my billboard in Times Square? Where's my full page ad in the New York Times?
Right. And they know which shelf is supposed to be on in the bookstore, even if it's something that's a little, cross-genre, which is almost everything I've written has been cross-genre to a certain degree. But cross-genre really confuses marketing people, I think. And if the message isn't clear from the marketing department, I think it's really easy for books to get lost. Mm. You know, booksellers aren't sure if they want to invest the time into reading your arc, you know, unless it's one of the blessed books that the publishing house has signaled this is a big book for us. Readers, I don't blame them. You know, if it's not clear to them, am I going to enjoy this book? It's so easy to just go on to the next new book that you've heard about and that, you know, you think might be for you. So yeah, that marketing piece is so important.
We'll get back to your more recent work because, you know, I don't want to make your publicist angry by not promoting it enough. But I do. You first came to my attention big time, not counting 2011, with The Hunger. And we talked about the success of that book and some of the reasons it was such a hit. But so you had a trilogy. The first one came out the gate strong, probably mixed, more mixed for the next two. And then The Hunger really like soared, just absolutely soared. What was that experience like and why? And by the way, it is about the Donner Party, you know, and that kind of thing. And I was thinking about you and your book recently because with the snow in California, Donner Pass was snowed in and they had all these semis like stranded. I'm thinking, have you all not heard? I mean, even if you missed the historical news, certainly you must have heard of The Hunger.
Well, I'll tell you, when I did the research trip for The Hunger that year on the Nevada side, they had had an epic snowstorm. And so when we were driving down the hilltop from the Nevada side, it was literally as high as a school bus, the sides of the banks, right?
Oh my
gosh. It wasn't even anywhere near as high as it was, at least what the record says.
For so when scary.
The Donners were there. So I really got that visceral feel of, you know, what you'd be up against without a car and snowplows and electricity and all those things that make modern life so much easier. Yeah, it's pretty amazing. You know, you can really see now people need to take that stuff seriously. So it was an interesting experience. It was a little different because it actually isn't just my book, even though I wrote it. I was actually brought into a situation where there were these, it's a book packager, except I wasn't hired. It wasn't a work for hire. And that's for folks who don't know, that's when you're hired to just write the book and that's it, like a ghostwriter, basically.
Right.
It said I'd only do it if it were a partnership. So it was a partnership with these people. Hmm. It was a company that was very young, but I had heard about them. The two principals were New York Times bestselling writers, and both of them had been editors at Penguin before.
Oh, interesting.
So it was very interesting. I thought, well, this will be an interesting experience to work with people with more experience than me, and maybe I'll learn a few things. So how it worked was they would come up with the general idea, at least for this one. They had the idea, let's do the Donner Party, but horror. And then we hammer out the outline together, and then I go off and write it. And they'll do a pass or two editing, and then we hand it into the publisher. So it kind of had this powerhouse feel. This was the first. They had had tremendous success with their other books, but they were all YA. Mm-hmm. And this was their first adult. So we had that going. Ridley Scott optioned the film rights before we even had a book deal.
Wow.
So, yeah, it was just like this, you know, tsunami wave of interest that, you know, we were lucky to have. It was the first of three historical horror novels. The second one is The Deep, which had to do with the Titanic. And we had super high hopes for it, right? Because there's legions of Titanic fans out there. And it came out the same week that the country went into lockdown for COVID.
Oh, wow.
And I mean, that experience, that month is burned into my memory, just how scattered and crazy and unbelievable the experience of that first month of COVID. Nobody wanted to talk about anything else, let alone a book, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So unfortunately, almost nobody knows that The Deep exists.
Well, you heard it here, for folks. And I haven't read that one either. So I'm as guilty as anyone.
Believe me, I don't blame anyone if they didn't hear that book. So yeah, it was an interesting experience. But by the end of the three, I decided that I'd had enough. I'd written the two spine novels by then, and I just decided I was going to go my own way. But, you know, I mean, that's one thing we can talk about. The model in some ways is very diverse now for a career in writing. You know, what kind of projects you can get involved in. You know, we can talk about whether it's detrimental to your career or, you know, whether it's a good thing. You know, in addition to the books, which I did both lines with Putnam, I also have been doing stories for Amazon, Amazon Original Stories, which has really been a godsend.
That's great.
For writers, yeah. I mean, there's just so many possibilities now, I think, for writers.
Well, I would like to talk about the fervor because, you know, for me, you know, my novel, The Reformatory, is also historical and it's influenced by real life events in history. But I added a fantasy element with the ghosts. And there's some similarities I see. I mean, actually, when the novels take place is similar. Yours is in the 40s, mine is in 1950. You're talking about the internment in Japanese Americans. So really, that event itself is one of the monsters in the story, just as Jim Crow is one of the monsters in The Reformatory. But you've added sort of this demonic infection, which I love. And I think horror has this very special power and metaphor to speak to both contemporary and historical events that are horrific in and of themselves. Where did the idea for that book come from? And why did you feel like you had to write it?
Well, I'll tell you, it's sort of a two-headed monster again. I mean, on one hand, it was the third book and we were being asked, you know, what is it going to be about? And at the time, I remember distinctly like going to Historical Novel Society conference and the editors panel, they were all saying, nobody wants to read anything earlier than the 19th century, you know, like stop. Really, World War II was about the only thing they wanted to buy. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I talked to my editor at Putnam about it and she said, yeah, you know, it's probably would have the better chance of success. And so the idea to do something with the internment camps came up. I have to say, on one hand, I was looking forward to the possibility of writing about it. I felt like I knew it pretty well because my husband's family had been interned. Mm. Not my side of the family. I'm half Japanese, but my mom came from Japan. So we didn't have that experience. I certainly knew about it, but not intimately. But over the, I can't remember how many years we've been married, over 30 years. You know, over decades with my husband's family, I learned a lot, not just from them, because I don't know how much you want to go into this, but people who are in camps, and this includes the Holocaust, really don't like to talk about the experience.
I absolutely know that from the civil rights memoir my mother and I wrote, even the 60s civil rights movement, some people did not want to talk about it.
Isn't that amazing? Once I learned more it's trauma. And, you know, I know what the folks went through. I talked to my father-in-law about it and some of Bruce's other relatives who had been in the camps. And, you know, I understand the embarrassment, the stigma that they were sent away basically to prison, right? Mm-hmm. And they didn't fight back. But anyway, so I looked forward to the possibility of being able to write on that. But on the other hand, I also kind of feared it because I wasn't writing a straight historical. I felt like in some ways I was being a little disrespectful to the stories and these people's experiences. Now, I will say here, I feel very differently about your book because I felt like you were very respectful to what people actually went through. My book, I think the supernatural element was maybe a little, I don't know.
I disagree. I disagree with you right there. I mean, I don't know what the extent of your research was, and I have not interviewed survivors as you did, but I felt that I learned. And one of the reasons I was very eager to read the book was not just because it was horror, but literally was because of that history. I wanted to feel that I was walking through that era and that experience with people who had been there. And of course, there's the horror element and the fantasy of the infection and the demon. But I felt that in a lot of ways, it was very grounded.
Well, I'd like to think that the part that showed the experience and what was in the people's heads was very grounded. It was just, I don't know. Maybe it's because I'm half Japanese and, you know, they just play with our heads so much when we're kids, you know, that you really have to be super, super respectful of the elders and all that.
Listen, and I know what you mean. Yes.
Yeah. And I just had a feeling that my, you know, some of my family members, nobody read it before it went out. I didn't let anyone read it because that would have been too crippling, right? That I wouldn't have had the freedom to go where I wanted to go. So one thing I'll say, though, is that the book wasn't supposed, I mean, some people hear about the infection and they think, oh, it's a COVID book. No, we actually came up with the idea before COVID. It was really about the hatred that was just sort of taking over this country at the time, starting in, you know, 2019. It was the beginning of COVID, but because of the politicalization of COVID, you know, there was this huge wave of violence against Asians in this country. And before that, just the hatred of certain people. That's what the story was supposed to be about. And it really opened my eyes. God, I was such an idiot. You know, for decades, especially at work, I saw a little bit. I understood that I was being discriminated against for being a woman. Mm-hmm. We can go into that, you know, being in defense and also being in a very technical field. Women are just, even to this day, not held in the esteem that they should be. But it wasn't until I kind of went through writing this book, I realized that my ethnicity was probably a part of it, too.
Oh, I see. So you learned about your own experiences in writing about these historical experiences.
Yeah, that book, The Fervor, was the first book I've ever written where the main character was my ethnicity, was Asian. I've always written from the perspective of white characters or, you know, half-breed characters. Oh, I shouldn't say that, but I'm one.
No, I mean, I have to think that comes with challenges and fears in terms of not wanting to show people. And I was still going through imposter syndrome on book tour. I met survivors of the Dozier School, and it was very jarring because I felt like, oh my God, did I have the right to tell this story? And one survivor at a meeting did thank me for writing it. So that was very, very helpful. But he could just as easily have had a more negative opinion about it. Like, it wasn't like that, you know, and because it wasn't, it was fictionalized. I did draw from history, but the reason I wanted to fictionalize it was so I could also make changes. And some people are going to just hone in on those changes. And then when you make it horror too, there are some people who just don't like horror. So Yes, and that's the reason it took me so long to realize I wanted to write horror as a younger writer, was because of my fear that it would not be respected as a genre, right? So you're already coming in like that. But I would imagine that it must have been a very, hopefully a freeing experience for you to really dig into your ethnicity in a way you had never had the opportunity to do it before. Or was it more daunting than freeing?
I don't know. I guess kind of both. I'm certainly glad I did it. No one has come after me and my husband's family, at least not to my face.
Great.
You know, because you're afraid of people thinking that you're just being, you know, an opportunist, that you're telling the story because, oh, you know, you're having the opportunity to do it or whatever. I feel like I was very true to much of the experience, right? Except for the supernatural.
Right. Yeah, I think you were too.
But, you know, you do worry about people disapproving. It's interesting, though, now that I've written three historical horrors and the short story, the one that actually won the Stoker, was also historical. It was about something I swore I'd never write about, which are werewolves and Nazis and Nazi werewolves. But it's a Nazi werewolf story. And it actually was incredibly fun to write.
Great.
But what I've learned through all of this is that history and horror actually is a great pairing, and it's for something you alluded to in the beginning, and that is it gives you like an excuse, like dealing with. Now, when I was a CIA analyst, one of the things I did was I was an analyst of atrocities and genocides in the 1990s, Rwanda, Tanzania, Liberia, Sierra Leone, the Balkans. I spent 2.5 years of my life working on the Balkans target, 5 warring factions. Real life is horrible. I say this all the time, and it's based on things that I, you know, had to work through. Much more horrible than anything you're going to read in a horror story. That's for sure. And if you haven't experienced yet, you're flipping lucky. So when you have this pretend horror, it gives people the opportunity to sort of peek between their fingers and deal with the real life horror. What happened? Thank you. Yes, it's surprising to me in some ways that I actually like ended up writing horror, because for a long time, I just thought what I had gone through with the genocides and everything was the most horrible thing. And what could be more horrible? And when I get that question, which I get asked a lot, you know, why do you write horror? What do you, you know, how did I come to it? It's because life is horrible. I mean, don't get me wrong. I've had a great life, but I've seen how really difficult it is for anyone to get through this life.
No, it is. It's very difficult. And horror is it's a sort of a gentle way of helping people process the emotions that they're experiencing from real life horror. Or as we talked about with Joe Hill in a recent podcast, rehearsing for real life's horrors. So when the bad thing happens, like my mother getting sick was the worst horror I've ever experienced. And what's even more horrible is knowing that as we go through life, we lose everybody, you know, or we lose ourselves first. Either we're going to lose the people we care about, or we're going to die before we lose the people we care about, neither of which is a great scenario. And I, you know, I'm morbid enough that that's never far from my mind and hasn't been since I was like 8 years old. Right. And for me, horror is a way of dealing with that in a way that is manageable and gives me clues about how to stand up and how to face it.
Right. And there's, you know, I have to say, we're kind of in a great time for horror right now. There's so many more horror writers, especially women. And, you know, I've really, the more I read it, the more I see, you know, what it's bringing to society, because I think a lot of the more current horror really is about building empathy and understanding mm-hmm. the other, or mm-hmm. understanding the terrible thing you have to face. There's a great writer, Rachel Harrison. She's, I think, got about 4 or 5 books out, and she tends to write feminist books. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I grew up in the era of, you know, the Equal Rights Amendment and everything. I tend to be a little bit of a pessimist when it comes to women's rights.
Right.
But she shows it from a very powerful, positive way, how women can deal with these issues. And, you know, I just take a lot of encouragement from these types of stories that are out there. And they're really showing us how to deal with those horrors and fears and difficulties.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk about the spy thrillers a little bit. Let's not give them short shrift. As you were describing what the marketplace is demanding, I was thinking to myself, there's no way that you are writing James Bond like novels, because you're such a grounded writer. So I'm thinking you're writing novels that are more like what it's really like to work in intelligence.
The novels, yeah. And I'm really lucky in that when the first one came out, a lot of retired intelligence people came forward and wrote to me and said, you know, this is the most realistic, especially from the culture point of view, you know, spy novel I've ever read. So that really helped. And the books have done pretty well. And we've been optioned, you know, both the novels ended up getting optioned.
Right.
But I did learn a lesson getting, it's so hard to get coverage from traditional quarters that will cover spy novels and stuff. And it's just so infuriating. Like I said, and I don't mean to brag or anything, but I had an incredible career. I left at a fairly high level as a manager, and I had the opportunity to do all kinds of amazing things. And yet, you know, when I was going to talk to media and stuff, I was told to pretty much put that light under a basket. And
that makes no sense to me, because, you know, the Booker part of me is like, you would be, that's an amazing guest. I mean, it's usually an advantage if there's a nonfiction story to accompany a novel, because it's so much easier for nonfiction writers to get interviewed for the most part.
Well, because I agree. And I think they've kind of learned that lesson a little bit. But in the beginning, I think we were hoping to, this is going to sound terrible, appeal more to women readers mm-hmm. who are not traditionally spy novels. And maybe they thought it was intimidating or something. I don't know. But so, for instance, I said,
it's badass.
I'm sorry?
It's badass. That's what it is.
Yeah, it's been an interesting journey. This gets back to that marketing piece, right? Where it seems to me so rare when the marketing is really spot on with a book, especially a novel. And a lot of times it's a miss for whatever reason. They guess what the, you know, reader reaction is going to, they miss, you know, misguess, I guess I should say. But, you know, it was things like, I said, do you want a, you know, a general or a politician blurb on the cover? I can get that for you. And they were like, no, we don't want you to. And then I would see these men, like especially debuts with, you know, General Petraeus or so-and-so blurbing the cover. And it makes this huge impression. And I just had to wonder, why am I being told, you know, to do it differently when, anyway. So I kind of tried to learn my lesson a little bit. We had an Amazon short story come out in September, was it? Called Black Vault, which is, it's about UFOs. Mm. Well, if you remember back to the 60 Minutes episode where the Navy came out and admitted that there were these unexplained aerial phenomena, I knew as soon as I saw that this is going to be big. There's going to be a congressional hearing. Every agency is going to have to do a similar report. And I started thinking, what would CIAs look like? And that's what I wrote. So it's very realistic as to how CIA would go through investigating a UFO incident. But it's the story of a CIA officer who 15 years earlier reports a UFO incident and it destroys his career.
Right.
And it ruins his life. And then rush to the present day where CIA gets the congressional directive and somebody appoints him to the task force that has to do the report and do the investigations. And he's sure it's somebody who's trying to drive him crazy and get him to quit before he hits retirement. But it ends up that he leads this team of younger people who are more open-minded and not afraid to fail. Like anybody who's spent any time at CIA, you're afraid to fail. Mm. And they actually uncover a huge, huge cover-up and this thing that's going to have world implications. That came out. We went on submission to film companies like 2 days after the last round of congressional hearings, which, if you remember, were a freaking circus. It was insane. It hit all the newspapers. The film rights went to auction. AMC picked it up, and the producers of Breaking Bad and the producers of The Walking Dead are going to be producing the show.
Holy cow. Well, listen.
It's a matter of timing, right?
I got to talk about your Hollywood journey. I mean, finish this story, but we have to come back to your Hollywood journey.
So the story of Black Vault, for your listeners who are thinking about career, is I did have to learn to pivot away from that realism, which I felt as a former intelligence officer and, you know, and that I owed it to my colleagues and everything else to write this grounded story. But that's not what the American people really want. They want something more fantastic. You know, they've cut their teeth on James Bond and Jason Bourne, these kind of over the top stories that promise a certain amount of glamour and blah, blah, blah. So I had to learn to reframe my stories to be more high concept and not quite so realistic. So I would say Black Vault, while it is grounded, is also very high concept. And I have another story coming out in July called The Spy Who Vanished, which all I'm going to say is Russian James Bond.
Oh,
very high concept, right? So that's what I'm trying now.
So you're going down that line. Are you pivoting away from horror for a while? When's your next horror story going to be published?
Well, I'm waiting to hear back from my agents. I did have a horror novel under contract. Here's another thing your listeners might be interested in. And it just could not come together. So even though I turned in the manuscript, we were seeing that, you know, it wasn't going to work, not in the way that we wanted. We wanted it to be a bigger book. It would have been my first contemporary. So luckily, I had the idea for another story, very high concept. And I just handed in the manuscript to my agents. So I'm waiting to hear on there, but we're hoping that we're going to be able to flip it in, you know, for the contracted work.
Well, that would be great. I mean, it really sounds like you're succeeding at doing both. And that's the important thing. I mean, it might not always feel that way. I'm sure there are ups and downs. So the first thing I want to ask you about is your Hollywood experience, it sounds like you're pretty content to option your books and you're not necessarily interested in learning screenwriting yourself.
Well, we had this conversation back in Miami, right? I'm curious. I can tell, you know, why I'm interested is because I do think screenwriters look at story differently. You know, they have different demands on the story.
True.
And that I could learn something from that for my novel writing. The novels seem to be a little bit more slower and, you know, they unfold in different ways. So I want to learn screenwriting to master that craft and be able to bring that stuff over to my story writing as well. But I'm finding that Hollywood just doesn't seem to want the novelist to be anywhere near the script. Like it, and I can understand because it's such a different thing and you have to learn how to do it. And it seems like in Hollywood, time is really of the essence. You have to be able to turn those scripts around or changes around fast. And so they want to stay with the proven, you know, someone who's proven they can do it rather than worry about the person who actually owns the rights, you know, screwing it up or going slow or something.
I mean, all of what you've said is true. I think it was worse 20 years ago in terms of the door being barred to the author. I think there are more openings now when you look at someone like a Victor Laval who has worked his way up to being a co-showrunner, even not just working on scripts, but running his own show upcoming on AMC for The Devil in Silver, writing scripts for horror noir. But it is a process. And honestly, I got to tell you, it's not for everybody. That's the thing. I love what you said at first about screenwriting, learning, giving you tools rather that you could use in your prose writing, because I find that to be very true from the outlining stage to visual symbols to visual storytelling. All of that is something screenwriting will bring you, whether or not you ever want to go to a pitch meeting or deal with all that, because that's a whole different experience than even you writing by, you know, you have other people you collaborate with on outlines already. So you're ahead of the game in some ways, because a lot of writers don't do that. They're just used to me, myself, and I. That's the first skill, is collaboration. If you're used to collaboration, you are one step closer to already being a screenwriter. But then you have to have the desire to put up with that long process of earning the right to write the screenplay. Mm-hmm. And that means being denied the right to write the screenplay over and over again, which is not fun. And you can ask yourself, I could be doing other things with my time right now, rather than being in this meeting trying to convince people to see things my way when they already see it a different way. And I don't know. I don't know how to advise you on it. I think it's a great idea to learn screenwriting for its own sake. I find it to be fun. And I love writing scripts. As I said, I wrote a spec script that will basically serve as a novel outline, at least loosely, which is tremendously helpful because it's way more fun to write a script for me than it is to just write like this happens and then this happens, you know, and to sort of see it in action. And it's almost like testing the concept in real time. But it's a journey. It's not temperament. It is not for everybody. So you really have to make that choice. Are you close to something hitting the air? I mean, you talked about Ridley Scott a while back.
Everything's in development. He optioned it for a couple of years, but we ended up pulling it back. And, you know, there was some writer working on a screenplay, but I don't know what happened to that. It goes on and off. That's another reason why I wanted to try a contemporary, though, is because selling historicals it's just like one extra obstacle. It costs more. It makes things more complicated.
Nobody's like hunting. Like, that's not on the top of anybody's list of what they're looking for. It's
right.
Period pieces. I mean, there are people who can break through with period pieces, but as a newcomer, certainly in screenwriting, it's tough. Yeah, it's a tough sell. How do you cope with the ups and downs? That's one of the things that we talk about in this podcast, is sort of creating the balance in your life so that you can have enough joy in creation that you're still writing, but then you have to also absorb these disappointments along the way, like you just talked about. You have and thank you for talking about that, because that's something that I think a lot of writers don't think about, is that even after you've published, even after you're a very well-established writer, sometimes you have a manuscript that doesn't work for you or doesn't work for your editor. How do you deal with that gut punch and keep your creative spirit alive?
Well, I'll tell you, this one did shake me a little bit, although I knew it wasn't going to work. It was one of these classic examples where you have an idea and your agent or your editor thinks that you should add this other thing to it. And I think that happens too, you know, if the whole cycle on publishing is so short. You're only as good as your last book. Doesn't matter how well your previous books. I mean, I'm being a little facetious, but depending on the circumstances, it
feels that way. Sure.
And so, you know, we really wanted the next book to be more of a breakout book. And so people get nervous and they start to want to throw the kitchen sink at something, because just like with Hollywood, right? Your concept gets watered down and things get added to it. And that's, I think, kind of the death of a great idea, because it can't be everything to everybody, right? You're going to lose what it's about. So I could see that this was coming, and I didn't want to have to spend 2 years trying to make this book work and ending up with something that was incredibly mediocre, mostly because I'd had this other idea and I knew it was going to be that it was, you know, high concept and it was going to do really well if I could just get to that book. And they wanted it too. So that worked out. But it did shake my confidence for a while. And I am a freaking crazy confident person. So, you know, it's a lot. Yeah. How I deal with stuff is I just keep really busy. This is not good for work-life balance.
Okay.
So disclaimer. I'm sorry, what?
Disclaimer.
Yeah. I am not a good person when it comes to that. So I'm kind of a workaholic. And if something isn't working, I'll just kill myself to try to make it work. This is the intelligence background. And because you can't fail. Or, you know, I'll just try to come up with the next project that I think will, you know, it won't go down the same negative path. I'll really try to figure out what went wrong. And okay, so what do I need to change the next time?
Well, are there any rituals, whether it's exercise, walking, meditation, anything like that for self-soothing restoration that you practice?
Soothing restoration.
Look them up in the dictionary.
I've really tried from after getting away from my last career, you know, to slow things down. That's one of the reasons why we moved out to the middle of nowhere. And I mean, I remember one day sitting there drinking coffee with my husband and telling him this, I never thought I'd be able to do this. Like just sit here and talk to you in the morning. Cause usually I was out the door, like at 5 o'clock or something, you know,
oh my goodness.
Didn't get back until the wee hours, that I wouldn't feel nervous, that there was something else I needed to do, that I could actually sit there and just relax for 20 minutes. So I do try to exercise a lot, but that's mostly because I was so out of shape for a while. Travel was difficult. Mm-hmm. And I threw my back out getting out of bed.
Oh, yeah. Familiar. or even worse, when you throw your back out while you're still just sleeping in bed. Exactly. Yeah. That is a motivator. Really helped encourage me to practice yoga at least once a week, so I wouldn't have to keep going to the chiropractor. Because I thought, okay, you know what? I'm going to fix this with yoga. It was a line at the time, but then I realized, oh, maybe I should really try to fix it with yoga. So I have been doing that. I've been doing something called the Five Tibetans. You know, a lot of it, sometimes we get motivated by pain. I think the key is just not to accept, oh, I guess this is how it is now, you know, because we can do things to change it.
Absolutely. Well, part of it is back when I was in my 30s, I was actually a part-time fitness instructor, because it wasn't bad enough that I was covering genocides all over the world. I had to, you know, like I was doing the Balkans at the time and I literally was working like 16-hour days, but I would also teach aerobics because that's how crazy I am.
Wow.
So I knew, right, that I needed to get fitter. It wasn't something that I could deny, and I knew how to get myself there. It was just, you know, I'd kind of given myself permission because of all the deadlines that writing came first. And if that meant a 15-hour day at the desk and no time for exercise, so be it, right? Mm. Now I do balance it out a little more, try to turn down assignments.
And that's so hard. And they haunt you later, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. But try to be realistic. Yeah. And now the biggest hurdle is trying to eat better.
Mm. Yes. Yes. There's always something. What you're doing, at least you're on the path. Let's just say that you're not as bad as you were making it sound. And I'm very glad for you and your husband that you have learned how to slow down, because that relationship needs to breathe, you know, which means time together, where even if you're not talking to each other, just being in each other's presence.
Absolutely. And he did not get that for over 30 years, because I was just really married to my career. I have to say, that's something I really envy about you and Stephen. You have such a great relationship. And also, you're so fearless. Like, yes, I mean, videotaping yourself doing the Thriller dance, you know, and putting on social media, that takes a very confident, secure person to be able to share those parts of herself with the rest of the world. And I really admire that.
Well, in this case, that wasn't my original plan, but I found that as I was learning it, having feedback was such an important part of my motivation. You know, my poor sisters or my friends would get these video clips. It's like, oh, I learned a new part today. And they're like, oh my God, leave us alone already. So it was almost like a last ditch effort to put it on social media so more people could see it. It's on my Instagram. I'm at Tananarive Du. It's on my, yes, I'm still on Twitter. I'm on Blue Sky. I'm on Threads. The video link is everywhere. It's also on YouTube, but it's unlisted, I think. So you'd have to find it through the social media. Yeah, I at least unlisted it. It's not public, right? So you have to be at least following me or know about me before you can find it. But that's just me trying to get an audience.
No.
I mean, what I did. I wanted to learn this and I learned it. I'm actually so excited still.
It is an exciting thing for a writer to, you know, put themselves out there. But that's what I mean. Like, you really got your head together. So, you know, you can do all this stuff. Writing is really tough, even if you're a confident person.
It is.
And I think you've achieved like this next level, you know, quiet confidence that enables you to do so many, just to be so sharing with other people. That's really
I totally appreciate that, but I'm just as terrified at having a deadline now as any new writer would be, frankly. It's very terrifying. But
what's your deadline?
Oh, early next year, like probably this time next year, March, April next year. So I've got about
a year to
bang that book out. And when the last one took 7 years, that's a scary thought. But, and this is a great segue to the flagship product that Steve and I sell as a digital download, our Life Writing Premium course. And our core tenet is a sentence a day. And I absolutely do agree. I heard Daniel Jose Older say recently that he wrote a whole essay telling writers they don't have to write every day. And I absolutely agree with the core of that sentiment. I think sometimes writers do get way, way, way too caught up in this idea you must always be writing or you're not a writer. There are plenty of days I don't write. Get plenty. Trust me on this. But I do find that when I am serious, and especially when I'm on deadline, and just as a practice, that sentence a day, like that short story I'm working on, I might not have a whole lot of time today to work on it, but I do want to write a sentence because I want to re-engage with it. I love writing. I love, like, the stress of life sort of gets shut out when I can disappear into a story. That's where I went when my mother was sick. I disappeared into my story. So a sentence a day is not like me taskmaster. It's a joy. Think of it as a joy to write that sentence a day. And often it turns into more than one sentence. And if you want to have more tips on writing, look at our Life Writing Premium course. It's a year-long, weekly module, digital download course. You take at your own pace, which is a combination of everything from lectures I did at the Geneva Writers Conference, lectures Steve has done, lectures I did when I was teaching in the MFA program at Antioch University. Check it out at www.lifewritingpremium.com. Thank you so much to our guest, Alma Katsu. Where can people find you in all the social media?
Well, the best way is to go to my website, which is almakatsubooks.com, and there'll be a pop-up to sign up for my newsletter. I find social media, the algorithms make it really hard, yeah, you know, for people to really follow you. I don't post a lot. I don't post as much as I used to post, for instance.
I understand that.
So the newsletter is really the best way. And I want to thank you again. It's so much fun talking to you and just getting to compare experiences. And I learned so much from you every time I talk to you. So thank you again.
Well, this has been great talking to you. You are a marvel. Oh my gosh. You know, I could talk to you for 2 hours, except I don't have 2 hours to do it. Thank you so much for being on the Life Writing Podcast. Now you all in the audience, go out and make yourself the hero or heroine in your own story. And as Steve would say, the hero in the adventure of a lifetime. Thanks for joining us, everybody.
You've been listening to the Life Writing Podcast. Join us next time for more conversations about creating the project of your dreams. For more information, go to lifewritingpremium.com and get ready to write for your life.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.